Blog Talk Radio.
Fascinating. It really is. I mean, I wish I had gone to law school and just gotten myself buried in texts and laws. You know, when I think back to the Fahrenheit 9/11 documentary, if that's what you want to call it, and they had the one congressman talking about, you don't expect us to actually read the laws. No, I find this fascinating, because every time there's some bizarre story about a new strange law, you actually go and read the law. It's fascinating stuff. It's amazing how a country where it was designed to allow people to have maximum freedom to, you know, to achieve the American dream, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, really goes far in establishing laws for things that you would not think there would be a law for. I wasn't sure if I was going to start the show with this, but hello, welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. I'm Mark Rattledge, back from a week hiatus. We'll get to that later. We're going to talk about Iran. We're going to talk about Iraq. I have more on this stupid mosque that I need to talk about. But I want to talk about the reason why I was off last week. But before I can even get to any of that, before we can get to those issues, I have to discuss this article that first appeared on Drudge and has found its way all over the internet. It was actually a Wall Street Journal story. That appears to be where this originated. The article is entitled "Sliced Bagels, Taxes on Top." Now, I like my bagels with a bit of schmear, a little bit of lox, salmon, you know, that sort of thing. But you know what's even better than that? I had a friend of mine who we joke around with each other a lot, and so I call her wife, and she calls me husband. And this started because on my wedding night, we had a kind of an after party for a lot of people had come into town from New York and other places. So we figured since people were coming from faraway places, we would have kind of an after party at our brand new house that we had gotten a couple months earlier. And so, it's after my wedding, and my actual wife, my new wife, was busy entertaining, and I was hungry and, you know, fat bastard. So I said I wish someone would bring me a plate of food, and this person did. And she forever became my second wife, because I am easy to please. Well, second wife, for the purposes of this conversation, actually made it a point to, when her and her actual boyfriend were down in, I believe it was Fort Lauderdale, went in, they were stopping by this traditional New York bagel shop, and they made it a point to make sure that they got me some authentic bagel food type stuff. because you can't just get the bagel, you know. And New York bagels are the only kind of good bagels, you know. You can make bagels here in Florida, but you got to make them the way they make them in New York with the special magical water or whatever it is. But they got whitefish. That's where I was going with this. They got whitefish spread. Now, it doesn't have to be a spread. You can just have regular whitefish, and oy vey, is it delicious. But I like whitefish on my bagel. Not a fan of Texas. Not Texas. Though I don't know how you would put Texas on a bagel. Taxes on bagels, yes. More important than Iraq, more important than Iran, more important than the Chinese housing bubble, more important than the ground zero or the near ground zero or the approximately in New York ground zero or that mosque over there controversy, more important than all that, New York is taxing bagels. Yes. But they're not just, I mean, first of all, this is actually on there's a law, folks. There's a law here. Chapter 12A1, sales and use tax. I actually spent the last 10 minutes of my show prepping for this. And I said I wasn't going to I don't even know if anyone's calling in right now, but I'm not even looking. Because I can't stop. I got to share this with the world. Chapter 12A1, sales and use tax of the New York State tax code, I guess. It's New York State tax code. It says, now there's this whole, it's like 5 pages of what food can be taxed and what can't be taxed. And on page 2, under bakery products sold by bakeries, pastry shops, or like establishments, you have bakery products sold by bakeries, pastry shops, or like establishments as hot prepared foods are taxable. Yes, if you're selling Hot Pockets, that's taxable. If you're selling any kind of hot pastry, that's taxable. So, bakery products that are kept warm by a heat source used to maintain them in a heated state or to reheat them are hot prepared foods. So if you've got them under a heating lamp, that's a taxable. Bakery products that are sold while still warm from the initial baking are not prepared, are not hot prepared food. So if mommy's baking an apple pie and leaving it to cool on the windowsill, apparently no, someone's not going to come along and slap a tax on it, should she try to sell it. Example, a bakery establishment toasts a bagel for a customer. The sale of the bagel is subject to tax. That's right. You ordered a bagel and said, I'd like mine toasted. That's a taxable. And that, and they actually made it a clause. Now, whether the bakery establishment has eating facilities or does not have eating facilities, bakery products excluding Well, let me get to this ridiculous article. So yeah, there's a whole series of clauses with regards to how you sell baked goods in New York and whether or not they're taxable. And eventually it gets to if you prepare it in any kind of way, if you slice it, for example. See, if I buy the bagel whole and go home, that's not subject to a tax as I understand it. But if I have them slice the bagel for me, then that's preparing it, doing air quotes again, by the way, and thus it is taxable. So this is the story from the Wall Street Journal. What's the tax on a bagel? Well, it depends on how you slice it. Yuck, 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 yuck. Or in the case of New York, if you slice it. State tax officials under orders from cash-strapped Albany to ramp up their audit and compliance efforts have begun to enforce one of the more obscure, you damn right it's obscure, distinctions within the state's sales tax law. In New York, the sale of whole bagels, this is what I was saying, isn't subject to sales tax, but the tax does not apply to sliced or prepared bagels. And they made it a point to say, with cream cheese or other toppings. Again, I prefer whitefish. According to the State Department of Taxation and Finance, and if the bagel is eaten in the store, even if it's never been touched by a knife, it is also taxed. This poor bastard, Kenneth Green, the owner of 33 Brugger's bagel franchises throughout New York, I'm assuming that they mean New York State, not New York City, says that the state demanded that he start charging taxes on all bagels except for those that remain intact and are consumed off-premises and are forced him to pay a significant sum in taxes the state estimated he owed. Mr. Green says the extra charge, about 8 cents a bagel, depending on the local rate, fills his customers with boiling rage. You're damn right. First the mosque, now this, now you're taxing bagels? Why, God, why? Of course I exaggerate, but you get my point. Now, this is apparently one of the many, many, many efforts to plug a, I think it's $9.2 billion budget in New York. I believe that's what's happening here. So there you go. They're now going to enforce obscure sales tax laws in order to bring in tax revenue. I actually read some of the comments on this. They were pretty funny. Someone said, yeah, there's a quote right here in the Wall Street Journal. I hope they don't come after me for that, said Florence Wilpon, a founding owner of Essa Bagel in Manhattan. Yeah, another person actually said, so long as they don't enforce this in New York City, it's all good. But the minute it comes to New York City, oh, you think the protest over the mosque is bad? Oh, wait till you see them starting to enforce the sales tax on sliced bagels. Interesting enough about this, I read a little bit further. I did a lot of research on this because it's truly an important subject. And there's actually discrimination. And I don't mean like against Jews per se, but there's discrimination with regards to how this is working. Because, again, I in all seriousness, I think this falls under, if it's a food staple that you need, it's not taxed. But if it's extraneous, if it's if you're going out to dinner or going out food, prepared food, then it's considered taxable, which means, and this is the crux of the discrimination, sliced bread, not the wrestling move, but sliced bread, Wonder Bread. You go to the store, you buy yourself a nice loaf of sliced bread. Not taxable. People are upset about that, by the way. It's discrimination, I tell you. We live in a strange world, man. Strange world indeed. If you want to give me a call, it's 646-915-8862. Again, the number is 646-915-8862. And, yes, we will be talking about Iran going nuclear. It didn't seem to – there was a headline about it on Drudge, and then it kind of just disappeared, and I don't know if anyone really cared. There's probably good reason for that. We're going to get into it. Before I went on my break, or while I was on my break, the last combat troops left Iraq. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But I gotta do the mosque again. And there's a point that I want to make about the mosque really quickly, and that is that it has become one of these issues where, I mean, where I started with this was being frustrated at the New York City not declaring the area, the entire area around Ground Zero, to be a memorial, to be a place where they would put a park and, statues, memorials, that sort of thing. Another word for it, and it's not on top of my head. But in any sense, they voted that down, and that's essentially what brought me into it. Because when this first got started, I actually did not pay that much attention to the mosque issue. Because I just, this is not my thing. Look, I know a lot of talk radio people, especially now, a lot of talk radio people don't get into a lot of the serious stuff, and they'll get into a lot of the emotional stuff because that brings in the calls, and it's easier for people to, I think, identify with stuff that's emotionally charged versus the serious nuts and bolts economic policy, or the Chinese housing bubble that's people saying is going to burst. It's easy to just get involved with the mosque issue. So I understand why they do it, but that's not my thing. I like to do the more cerebral stuff, like taxing bagels. So having said that, we had this issue where where New York, Council in New York said, you know, this is not a memorial, this is a financial district, and they can do whatever they want with their property. And I got a little annoyed about that and kind of acted sort of knee-jerk emotionally, and I've already talked about that. That's over. Here's the thing. When the argument starts out as, I don't care where they build a mosque so long as they don't build it on hollow ground where 3,000 Americans died, I'm with you. I get that. I support that. I've written about that, and I'm fine with it. The problem is it's kind of horseshit, and here's why. Now, I'm sure many people probably genuinely feel that way. God knows I do. Okay, fine. The problem is, and actually, the Daily Show did a really good job of dealing with this, oddly enough. I die a little inside when I realize that the Daily Show does a segment that's closer to the truth than any of the cable news programs. But that's an issue for another day. What's happening is not that there's an objection to this mosque in particular, which I think pushes the needle toward sympathy for that point of view. It is actually the issue becomes people don't want any more mosques to be built, period. And I have all kinds of sound here, and I'm going to break this down. But what started out as it's insensitive to put the mosque there has started to erupt into full-blown Islamic hate. And look, this is, again, one of those deals where I look at the conservatives, I look at the Republican Party, I look at, you know, those, my brethren on the right, and I ask, why? Why do you insist on creating these emotionally charged issues concerning Muslims out of nothing for no reason? There's already articles being written about how Muslim Americans who were registered Republican, oddly enough, are leaving the party en masse. And we're going to get to that. But, you know, first, I want you to hear this.
Dueling protests in New York over plans for a proposed mosque and community center near Ground Zero. Opponents say it's an issue of sensitivity to the victims of the 9/11 terror attacks, but many in the international press are portraying the debate as a litmus test for American intolerance of Islam. A reporter for Canada's CTV suggests there's irony in the growing debate.
Indeed, a project that was supposed to foster a better understanding of Islam seems to have done just the opposite, raised anti-Muslim tensions all across the country, and just weeks before Americans mark another anniversary of September 11th. It's not about religious freedom, they say, it's about sensitivity. And it doesn't matter that there's already another mosque in the neighborhood, they simply don't want it.
In the Sydney Morning Herald, one writer wonders whether opposition to the mosque is just another sign of global Islamophobia, coming on the heels of high-profile moves aimed at Muslims in other countries. Muslims worry that the campaign has become caught up in the same racially tinged Clash of Civilizations campaign to ban Muslim women in France from wearing Islamic garb, or Muslims in Switzerland to build minarets on their houses of worship. But there's disagreement over what's the real issue behind the controversy. A CBS reporter says that's simple. It's all about the location.
Ironically, the location has been used as a mosque for months, while the new building would not even be visible from Ground Zero. Proximity is what's at issue here. While the proposed Islamic Cultural Center is 2.5 blocks away from where the Twin Towers fell, World Trade Center 7, which also fell and has now been rebuilt, is right here.
In fact, the location has become such a heated topic of debate, the Associated Press is advising reporters not to refer to the community center as the, quote, Ground Zero Mosque, but rather the mosque near Ground Zero. But an Islamic studies professor tells Fox News, for the mosque's critics, it isn't about the wording.
The very fact that there's this immense controversy building up around this mosque so near Ground Zero simply means that Muslim leaders don't fully understand the sensitivities of what happened on 9/11.
Stay with Newsy.com as we continue to bring you multiple...
All right, so what's happening here is we're just going batshit crazy over this mosque issue, you know, with the premise being but if they just didn't build it there. But it's not just that. Let me quote for you. And again, it is hard, for someone like me, who not a racist, not a, you know, deathly afraid of Muslims, can separate the difference between terrorists and people of a faith, any faith. You lose people like us. This is my, you know, it's not even so much that I want to talk about the mosque. I want to talk about the Republican Party and how it just shoots itself in the foot. It seems, I've said this before, it seems like the Republican Party, all it wants is really, really rich people and devout evangelical crazy Christians, and we'll get to them in a moment, and to hell with everybody else. You can't win in this country with just that. And I'll get to, George Bush didn't just get elected with rich people and evangelicals. There were more people voting for him at the time. And in the first election, just barely. But with the policies that they put forth and issues like this, where they create huge racial, emotional tension, you drive people who are closer to the center of your party out of the party entirely. Christ, the only reason why, I mean, there's a, here in Florida, there's a primary tonight, and the only reason why I'm even still Republican at this point is to vote in the primary. Otherwise, I'd be independent. I'm never going to vote Democrat. But that's the, you know, that's the thing. I was driven at a young age out of the Green Party, and I've never been Democrat, ever. But I was a part of the Green Party, and those people are nuts! You know, watching the protests in... I forgot to turn my phone off. Watching the protests of the Iraq war and just having been exposed to any number of protests in New York City for any number of reasons, you got to see up close the ugliness that's within, you know, the MoveOn.org side of the Democrat Party. And I've always said, you know, while liberals may have some decent ideas, I don't want to be associated with those people, and therefore I won't be a part of that party. It's getting that way with the Republicans, too. This argument that, you know, days ago I was arguing in favor of, if they had just been sensitive and moved the mosque and said, shit, we're sorry, didn't think you, you know, thought you were over it, you know, thought this would help, sorry. They had actually said that. The Imam Ralph, he'd come out and said, all right, listen, you know, we effed up, sorry, we'll move it. I was there. I was with that. The problem is, that's not really the issue. For too many people. There's an article in the New York Times from August 7th. Okay, that's how long this stupid mosque issue has been going. Like, what? Every summer, it seems, we get involved in these asinine, emotional, non-news stories. But this is a collection of places throughout the U.S. that are not close to ground zero, that have nothing to do with 9/11, where there's no other way to say this. Assholes have decided they don't want religious freedom. You know, I used to get upset when people said, if you vote Mike Huckabee for president, he's going to bring a Christian theocracy to America and we're going to lose religious freedom. And I said, you're an idiot to anyone that said that. I don't think Mike Huckabee wants to do that, but I'm pretty sure if he got elected, there would be evangelicals demanding it. In Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Republican candidates have denounced plans for a large Muslim center proposed near a subdivision, and hundreds of protesters have turned out for a march and a county meeting. Tennessee! In late June, in Temecula, California, I've actually been there, it's a very nice place, members of a local Tea Party group, you know, the Tea Party, all we want is for the stop spending, and we hate Muslims. In late June in Temecula, California, members of a local Tea Party group took dogs and picket signs to Friday prayers at a mosque that is seeking to build a new worship center on a vacant lot nearby. Dogs? Did they bring hoses, too? Are we going to go right back to the 60s? In Sheboygan, Wisconsin, A few Christian ministers led a noisy fight against a Muslim group that sought permission to open a mosque in a former health food store bought by a Muslim doctor. At one time, neighbors who did not want mosques in their backyards said the concerns were over traffic, parking, and noise, the same reasons they might object to a church, a synagogue, or a synagogue. But now the gloves are off. By the way, not only this article doesn't seem to mention it, but there's also been denials of mosques in Brooklyn, where there are already mosques, and Staten Island, where there are already mosques. This is ridiculous. But I'll tell you what. People screaming and hollering and saying, we don't want a mosque, no more mosques, no, you know, or if we don't want any more mosques in the United States. You got too many as it is. I would almost accept that as opposed to this stupid shit.
A Florida church has a highly controversial plan for commemorating the terrorist attacks of 9/11, one that has caused outrage among many Americans of all faiths.
Where we're going to collect every donated, every purchased and brought Quran here to the property of Double World Outreach Center, and we are going to burn them publicly.
The city of Gainesville has told the church that book burning of any kind is against the fire code, but Ashley Coleman of WTEV reports the church has no intention of backing down.
But this week, the Deaf World Outreach Center was denied a burn permit by Gainesville Fire Rescue. The church says that's not stopping them, though. The church told me, quote, there was no legal reason to turn us down. It was strictly a political move. We will, on 9/11, still burn Korans.
Attorney Lawrence Walters also says the church has a right to hold the book burning. He tells WOFL that burning the Quran is core political speech, which is protected by the First Amendment.
What we have here is the government, being the city of Gainesville here, denying a permit to engage in this protest. It appears that they're doing so because of their disagreement with the nature of the protest. And that's a First Amendment problem. The church has the rights to do this. In fact, they have the right to ignore the permit requirement if it imposes an unconstitutional burden on speech, which I believe it does.
But even if the church has a right to the protest, that doesn't mean the community supports it. An Orlando Sentinel editorial accuses Dove World Outreach Center of trying to gain attention through outrageous protests comparable to those of the controversial Westboro Baptist Church, a church perhaps best known for protesting the funerals of fallen soldiers. Like Westboro, the Dove Center deserves nothing but public scorn for this hate-filled stunt. The best outcome would be for this so-called church to slink back into anonymity. But rather than scorn, one group plans to fight back by promoting understanding. The Book of Signs Foundation, a nonprofit that gives away copies of the Quran in English, promises to distribute 50 Qurans to every copy burned by the church. A press release reads, our campaign will let such people know that whatever symbolic gestures of hate they want to portray, they will be in vain and will only encourage us to increase our efforts at education. So what do you think? Does the Dove World Outreach Center have a right to burn the Quran? I'm Melissa Caverly for Newsy.com. Multiple sources.
Your movement loses credibility when those within it do book burnings. Okay? Rule number one, when you start doing Nazi stuff, your movement, whatever it is, loses credibility. People who, with moderate sensibilities, people who tend to look at things logically, people who are not bigoted, you've lost them entirely, and you can't win elections without them. There's just not enough far-right evangelical Christians in this country to win an election based on solely meeting their needs. And of course, this whole stupid mosque issue has taken yet another turn for the ludicrous in the latest thing, and I really thought this was going to die, but the latest thing to happen, like to keep this going all summer long, and looks like it's going into fall now, is AtlasShrugs.com, I believe is the name of the website, pulled up audio from the guy who's leading the movement to build this mosque. His name is Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, who is on one side, as I said 2 weeks ago, one side said he's an enemy of Al-Qaeda and has worked with the FBI and is currently on a diplomatic mission throughout the Middle East on the U.S. dime. And the other side says, you won't show us the funding. You're being funded by terrorists, and this is a terrorist plot, and the mosque is a terrorist headquarters, not unlike Cobra. So, I'm only going to play a part of this. I'm going to play the one that seems to have driven most of the right insane, but also has the most to do, because he said a whole bunch of stuff that's pissing people off on the right, but it's this part in the beginning that actually has something somewhat to do with this issue. And it'll start any minute now.
It arises, sir, from the fact that from political problems and the history of the politics between the West and the Muslim world. We tend to forget in the West that the United States has more Muslim blood on its hands than Al-Qaeda has on its hands of innocent non-Muslims. You may remember that that the U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq led to the death of over 500,000 Iraqi children. This has been documented by the United Nations.
Okay, so one, the big brouhaha statement was that the American military, the American government, has more blood on its hands than Al-Qaeda. So the headline was Ground Zero Imam says America worse than Al-Qaeda. Okay, that is the breakdown of what this was about, where he says we're worse than Al-Qaeda. That's what they're saying. Okay, then he followed that up with U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq led to the death of over 500,000 Iraqi children. Okay. And here's the response to that. This is an audio. This was actually an article I found on, of all places, Fox News, under the headline, State Department Aware of Ground Zero Mosque Imam's Controversial Remarks. And the State Department says they're aware of the remarks that he made in 2005. He said that, by the way. It was in Australia. And State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley said, we're aware of those remarks. And I would just caution any of you that choose to write on this that once again you have a case where a blogger from Atlas Shrugged has pulled out one passage of a very lengthy speech. If you read the entire speech, you will discover exactly why we think he is rightfully participating in this international speaking tour. On the substance of Ross' 2005 accusations, none other than former Bill Clinton has defended the sanctions, some of which took place during his years in the White House. Clinton and other diplomats assert that Saddam Hussein's regime corrupted the sanctions and denied humanitarian aid to his own people. Crowley also revealed Roth's activities over the next few days, which the State Department has been reluctant to do before Tuesday. All right. So to sum up the Ground Zero Mosque story, part 5 million. He says in this one particular part of the tape in 2005 in Australia that we have more blood on our hands than Al-Qaeda has the innocent blood of Muslims on their hands. I'm not keeping score, okay? I don't, and without other context, I have no idea what he's getting at there. Now, the thing with the sanctions, whatever. I have no what bigger point he was trying to make. I'm sure if somebody cut and pasted stuff from this particular broadcast, it'd make me sound like a lunatic too. Who the hell knows? But that is the latest down in the football game of Ground Zero. So there has been some really funny stories about this. Not funny if you're the actual guy this happened to. But apparently there was a guy walking around in a skull cap in New York City, and he got roughed up. His people said he was a Muslim, and of course now the Daily Show, the Colbert Report, she had him on TV, and I'm not even a Muslim! And I believe he added to that, I'm not even supposed to be here today! In summation, for the right to have lost its mind the way it has over this Ground Zero mosque has completely knocked the wind out of whatever legitimate protest, legitimate idea that was behind it. And more to the bigger point, because this too shall pass, if you continue to drive everybody out but evangelical Christians and rich people, you're not going to have a Republican Party. You're going to have Democrats and Blue Dog Democrats, okay? You're going to have the Marxist, socialist, hate America, one worlder Democrat Party, and the Blue Dogs. That's what's going to be left in Washington. You're killing the party, and you're killing me, Smalls. That brings us to more than the midpoint of the show. Big announcement, and part of the reason why I took off last week was that I found out that my wife and I are having a girl. We are going to have a baby girl come January. And we're going to name her Lillian Catherine Radulich. So in honor of this happy occasion, a song here, it's actually a cover of a Who song called Pictures of Lily, and this version is actually by David Bowie. So to my unborn daughter, who before she even arrives on the planet will have a fully filled iPod full of classical music and some other stuff me and her mother like. So anyway, here it is, David Bowie's cover of Pictures of Lily.
I got so sick of having sleepless nights.
My daughter, who is yet, who will be here in January. We're already putting together. She's going to inherit her mother's pink iPod Nano, and I'm filling it up with music so she can listen to music in her swing and be comfortable. And yeah, I got too much time on my hands. Breaking news for those of you living in Florida who are listening to the show: Kendrick Meek has won the Florida Democratic primary election. With 39% of precincts reporting Mr. Meek received 55% of the vote. His main opponent, Jeff Green, received 33%. Marco Rubio won the Florida GOP primary. Rubio, at 39% reporting, held 85% of the vote. Okay, you pretty much knew that was going to happen. So he will do the three-way dance with Charlie Crist and... Kendrick Meek. In the race for governor, Democrat Alex Sink won his party's nomination. Mr. Sink received 70% of the vote with 37% reporting. But the one that I'm really interested in, now that since Crist wasn't running against Rubio anymore, at least not yet, not as a Republican, was the GOP race for governor between Rick Scott and Bill McCollum, who had the dishonorable, dubious distinction of having the worst frickin' political debate I have ever seen. I've seen wrestling promos that were better argued than this. This was terrible. Whoa. It looks like Rick Scott's actually leading Bill McCollum, but it's 47-43. 47-43 with only 38% reporting. So, you know, who the hell knows? So I'm pulling for Rick Scott because I don't like Bill McCollum. We'll see what happens. That's breaking news there. All right. We've got about 20 minutes left of the show, roughly. And I do want to get to a couple of topics here. So we left Iraq. 646-915-8862 if you want to give me a call. It's again, 646-915-8862 if you want to get on the show the last few minutes that are remaining. The last combat brigades left Iraq, and there were 50,000 left behind, and they are in a almost a consultancy position where they're going to continue to help train the Iraqi troops and train the police, and they will still carry guns, obviously, in case fighting breaks out. But they're essentially to consult and train and help with the transition. But essentially, U.S. involvement in the war is over. And I actually wrote about this over the weekend. And I just asked the question: was it worth it? Now, I was very bullish on the war when it started. And I never believed anything about the WMDs being there. If they were there, they were there. If they're not, they're not. Maybe they're in Syria. Maybe they were never there at all. Who the hell knows? Who cares? I never bought that line of reasoning. My thought on this was that under Bush, we would have a very bold, violent, strong foreign policy military presence in the Middle East for the purposes of dismantling terror networks and stabilizing the region. And again, just look at a map. What better place to do that than Iraq, which is surrounded by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, Kuwait, not to mention Israel and Lebanon. So, I mean, just from a strategic point of view, if you're saying we need to set up shop in the Middle East in an area where we'll be able to put down stakes and do operations from there, Iraq was perfect. It was the perfect location, which, if you're George Bush, you really can't sell the American people on it. I got it, but you know, that's a hell of a reason to say we're going to go to war in an age where people are not so enthusiastic about going to war. And, you know, maybe we never have. You know, it always takes like a remember the Maine kind of a thing to get us really jazzed about the idea of going to war. And so the WMDs was the remember the Maine of the time. Then, of course, they changed it to, once the WMDs became a non-issue, they changed it to, well, we're deposing of a dictator and we're bringing freedom to the Iraqis. Yeah, okay. Here's the thing, and here's for me where it all switches. I was really enthusiastic about this, including signing up for the military and being turned away, because I would have gone. But here's the problem. If there's anybody in the Bush administration that should have been brought up on war crimes, it was really Don Rumsfeld. Don Rumsfeld thought that the best way to deal with any war was to have a sleek, slithery, snake-like military. You know, it was a light military, move fast, lightning strikes. And it's weird that you can become the Secretary of Defense and have so little understanding of how war works. If you're going to invade another country, you have to smash it. You have to break up the infrastructure. You have to block trade. You have to grind it to a halt. You have to break the will of its people. We might still be in Japan today had we not dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, which broke the will of the Japanese people, who would have kept fighting ad infinitum. And I thought, before we went into Iraq, when we were shock and awe, we're going to go in there with shock and awe, we're going to kick some ass, that we were A, there to stay, that we were going to have an eternal presence, big military base in Iraq, that it would be 20 to 50 years before we would turn that place over to any kind of local government. Because go look at your history. How long did it take to rebuild Germany? How long did it take to rebuild Japan? How long did it take to rebuild most of Europe? Eddie Izzard jokes about this, actually, in one of his bits. You know, England was just ended rationing in, like, the 90s, he quipped. You know, but the point being, World War II ends in the 40s, and it takes decades for it to really piece itself back together again, and then longer to become affluent in the world. People in this country wanted Iraq to be over in 20 minutes. Don Rumsfeld apparently thought that was possible. That, to me, is, you know, not to be histrionic about it, but that's sending troops to die for no reason. Not to mention all the reports of sending them without proper equipment and all of that. But just the whole idea of we're going to fight this war, but we're going to fight it dumb, really bugged me. And then we're not going to stay. You know, I understand all the Democrats wanted to do was get out and blah, 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 but what was this all for? Why? You know, at the end of the day, what did we accomplish? As we're leaving now, the Iraqis, I'm not going to play the sound, I don't have any time, but you know, there's quotes from Iraqis saying, we love America, we hate the soldiers, you know, we can't wait for you to leave, don't leave. There's reports that the Iraqi government since March can't get its shit together and get leadership going because of something along the lines of a tied vote across the board, something along those lines. This country's in no shape to take care of itself. It wouldn't have been for another, like I said, 20 to 50 years. But we just don't live in that world anymore. We don't live in a world where people will tolerate even something that resembles, quote-unquote, empire. Al-Qaeda can blow more stuff up in the United States. We're never going to have enough people in this country to bear down and accept the gruesome reality of what it is we have to do and what we have to face. We're just not that country anymore. I don't know if we ever really were. But I have no faith in my fellow Americans to take on the burden. So what was the point of going to Iraq in the first place? We should have stayed home. You know, in retrospect, I'm almost mad that George Bush took us to war in Iraq when this country would never accept it. You know, and I'm sorry, for the 5 minutes that we did because we thought there were nukes there doesn't count. This country doesn't want to go to war, ever, for any reason. Now, if the Chinese Empire, if the Chinese military shows up in California with tanks, hell, maybe some in the country will want to fight back. The others will just learn Mandarin. It's sad. It's sad that so many American men and women died for a cause that we were never behind. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating for me to deal with that from this vantage point. But I don't want to go out on I'm not going to have time to get to the Iran issue. I'll probably get to it another time. Though if you want to read my thoughts on Iran and the multipolar world, you can go to 411mania.com/politics and read my article, Nuclear Iran. Where'd it go? What do I call this thing? Nuclear Iran in the Multipolar World. It's about the world as it is right now, kind of a little bit about what I just talked about, but it is the world as it is right now through the guise of Iran's nuclear power plant, Bushehr, being fed nuclear fuel by Russia. It's a great piece, more important than the mosque, I tell you. And I think you should read it. All right. So I don't know how many of you watch MMA, and if you just kind of tune in for the politics and don't care about MMA, well, here's to you. But got a chance to finally sit down and watch an entire Strike Force card. It was Strike Force Houston in last Saturday. And the UFC, they are not. Here's the recap.
Two Strike Force title belts were up for grabs Saturday night as the promotion invaded Houston's Toyota Center. In the main event, Strike Force light heavyweight champion King Mo Lawal battled Team Nogueira prodigy Rafael Feijão. The night got off to a good start for Lawal as he made his way to the cage in typical pro wrestling fashion.
But right now he's styling and profiling like one of his heroes, Nature Boy Ric Flair, a pro wrestling fan growing up. He gets the entertainment value of MMA and putting it all together with another ostentatious entrance. And we wonder, what is that umbrella for?
You can't have that sunshine on you when you're the king.
In rounds one and two, Lawal struggled to take the bigger Feijão to the canvas as the Brazilian stuffed several takedown attempts. However, the former Big 12 champion held his own in the stand-up, landing crisper shots and effectively dodging Feijão's looping power punches. In the third stanza, Feijão connected with a punishing right hand to the chin and then landed flush with a knee from the clinch. The challenger charged forward and dropped King Mo flat on his back with a fierce right hand. Sensing the title slipping from his grasp, King Mo instantly shot in for a takedown. Dejao stuffed the attempt and connected with a series of vicious elbows to the head. Referee Big John McCarthy had seen enough and called the fight 74 seconds into the round as Dejao claims the Strikeforce Light Heavyweight Championship, improving to 10-2. In the co-feature, Brazilian Ronaldo Jacare Souza battled U.S. Army veteran Tim Kennedy for the Strikeforce middleweight title. The fight was evenly contested over 5 rounds as the submission ace Jacare was unable to secure a takedown, but winded up on his back several times courtesy of Kennedy. The American outstruck the former Abu Dhabi champion 207-186 throughout the bout, but Jacare landed the more effective shots and inflicted more damage. After 5 rounds, Jacare emerged as the champion on scores of 49-46 and 48-47 twice. In an entertaining lightweight tilt, KJ Nunes met UFC veteran George Gurgel. Nunes utilized his striking to pick apart the Brazilian in the opening stanza, while stuffed Gurgel's lone takedown attempt. As the opening round came to a close, or perhaps a split second later, Nunes unleashed a powerful left hook that dropped Gurgel, although he would fight another round. Like a shark smelling blood, Nunes pounced on his adversary in the second period, dropping him with another sharp combination. The fight did not end without its share of controversy as Nunes appeared to connect with an illegal knee to a downed opponent as the referee was stopping the contest. Regardless, Nunes picked up his 10th career victory and appears to be a frontrunner to challenge either lightweight King Gilbert Melendez or face welterweight champ Nick Diaz in a rematch. In the opening contest, former WWE superstar Bobby Lashley took to the cage against unhurdled full-time firefighter Chad Griggs. Lashley implemented his game in the first round, taking Griggs down and smothering him with his top game. However, it didn't take long for Lashley to start gassing, and Griggs would take full advantage, landing counterpunches and even busting Lashley wide open. As time was expiring in the second round, Lashley failed on a lazy takedown attempt, and Griggs unloaded with punches to the head. Clearly disoriented and rocked by the blows, referee John Shorley called the fight at the end of this frame, awarding Griggs with the upset TKO victory and his 9th career win.
Okay, first of all, I'm big into marketing and the way things look on television, but let me tell you this. Strikeforce looks so Bush League. They're akin to TNA wrestling. You know, they've got this jungle gym set up in the beginning with the ramp that goes out to the cage, and it just looks terrible. I mean, it looks bad. It looks cheap. It looks poorly made. You know, I love the sort of the pomp and circumstance of the UFC guys that come out. You know, they've got their whole team behind them, and they got the check area where they, you know, and they walk in, and it looks like a real fight. Strikeforce comes off looking like it's a pro wrestling thing, which if you're an MMA organization, it's probably not the look you want. It looked like crap. But I want to talk about Bobby Lashley for a second, because there's always been this sort of comparison between Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley, who wrestling fans like to call Black Lesnar for a variety of reasons. And, it's funny and all that, but then Brock goes and goes and leaves the WWE and he goes into MMA. Bobby Lashley leaves the WWE and goes into MMA. They're both heavyweights. They were both fairly dominant. Actually, up to this fight, Bobby Lashley was 5-0, and Brock Lesnar actually had one loss. And of course, it was to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu jackass Frank Mir, who he then turned into hamburger meat in their second match. But yeah, so this is comparisons between Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley, and I've always said if you put wrestlers in there. Guys whose, you know, their bread and butter is either Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or wrestling, you're going to have a better time over guys whose primary offense is striking or ground and pound, as the Brock Lesnar-Shane Carwin fight proved. So I had a lot of hope that Bobby Lashley would use his wrestling to bring guys to the ground. And this is what I said about the Brock Lesnar-Shane Carwin fight. I had predicted he was going to win by submission, and he did, because who the hell expected that? But the other thing is, wrestling is only part of the game. And having wrestled in high school many, many years ago, it's not just, about pinning the guy, you know, just like it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You know, you tie him up, try to make him submit, etc. So the whole concept of, well, Brock Lesnar doesn't have submissions is horseshit. He's a wrestler. Of course he's got submissions. And he showed it by making Shane Carwin tap out. Now, here's the thing with Bobby Lashley. my dog doesn't like Bobby Lashley either. Bobby Lashley should have wrestled Chad Griggs to the ground. Yes, Hume, I understand. Bobby Lashley should have wrestled Chad Griggs to the ground, and when the ground and pound wasn't working, and he had a dozen opportunities to put him in a triangle choke, he should have. What happened in this fight is the big worry about guys, you know, coming in from other sports to do MMA, is that they there's the possibility of them being one-trick ponies. Of course, this was the criticism of Brock Lesnar. You know, he fights, Texas Crazy Horse guy, and he mauls him. You know, he punched out Randy Couture, who we'll get to momentarily. He drove Frank Mir to the ground and punched him in the face, and everyone kind of thought the same thing. Okay, this is what Brock Lesnar does. You know, lay and pray. You know, he's a big dude, so if he knocks you down and he just sits on you, you know, it's going to take a lot of energy out of you, especially trying to get him off you. And then he surprised everybody by taking a couple of shots to the mush, more than a couple being fair, and bringing Carwin into the second round, using his cardio, using his submissions, using his wrestling, he won that match. Now, you'd think Bobby Lashley would be at least watching that fight thinking, that guy's gone to something there. No, all this asshole did was drive Chad Griggs to the ground, try to ground and pound him, and when the guy's chin is apparently made of granite, and after the first round, Lashley was gassed. This is the opposite problem that Brock Lesnar was having. So, again, he's sitting there. He had to see this match. He was just hovering over Chad Griggs, not taking advantage of any possible submissions. He probably would have gotten it and won the match. And then, of course, by the end of the second round, he was so bloated and out of breath, he couldn't continue. Now, being fair, he also had a pretty nasty gash under his eye and bled like a stuck pig. But, you know, anybody watching that saw him quit on the stool, essentially. You know, he didn't want to do it anymore. And I think that's the big difference between Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley. Bobby Lashley didn't get exposed as just being a one-trick pony at Strikeforce Houston. He got exposed for having zero heart. Here's a guy who came into Strikeforce thinking, oh, I'm just going to walk in there and punch people in the mush, and I'm so strong, and that's all I have to do. And then he found a guy, with a piece of rock for a chin, and it didn't work. And when he didn't work, he gave up. As opposed to a guy like Brock Lesnar, who gets knee-barred, and comes back and learns from his mistake. It was a completely different fight between the two mirror matches for Brock Lesnar. We may never see Bobby Lashley again in Strikeforce, the way he looked. Now, there's rumors now of him fighting Batista, another ex-WWE guy, 40 years old, full of injuries, et cetera, et cetera. And at first, when Bobby Lashley was a marketable guy, Bobby Lashley, the marketable heavyweight, that might have been a good fight. Now it's, as a lot of the MMA, pure MMA fans would call it, it's a freak show. It's going to be a freak show fight. Which is frustrating, because that brings me to my second point about Strikeforce. The only reason why I even know of this company is because I've spent a lot of time trying to learn as much as I can about MMA and following it. And then my initial introduction to it, sadly enough, was the Fedor fight. I'd heard Fedor was like 40 victories or some crap in a row. He was the monster of pride fighting in Japan. And so I really wanted to see him fight. I like watching heavyweights fight. It's one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of Brock Lesnar. And then, of course, in the first round, before I could even tune into the fight, he tapped out to a triangle. It's unbelievable. But, Strikeforce does not market their guys well. I mean, one of the things the UFC does really, really well is it builds up a great story. You know, they've got an event coming up this Saturday between UFC 118. It's the rematch between BJ Penn and Frankie Edgar from earlier in the year when they fought in Dubai. It was the night that Anderson Silva performed the Nutcracker Suite while he danced around Damian Maya. And Dana White pronounced that the worst night of his life. But wrapping this up really quick, that night, BJ Penn did not show up for that fight. I don't know who was in that ring with Frankie Edgar, but that was not the BJ Penn that, you know, pounds of the guys into mush. So he fights Frankie Edgar, and of course Frankie Edgar wins a controversial 5-round decision. The worst way to win a title, by the way, is by decision, you know. But whatever. So everyone says, you know, okay, BJ Penn deserves a rematch, and so he's getting it this weekend, it's a sure bet that BJ Penn is going to walk out probably within the first two or three rounds with the title. He's going to pound Frankie Edgar into hamburger meat. But the other story on this, and this is the difference again between Strikeforce and the UFC, is James Toney, a former professional boxing champion in multiple divisions, versus UFC Hall of Famer Randy Couture. And everyone's saying James Toney doesn't have a chance, but you know what? Brock Lesnar didn't have a chance against Randy Couture either, and what looked like the weirdest punch I've ever seen punched out Randy Couture and took his title. And this is like, you know, Brock Lesnar's third or fourth professional fight or some crap. So I don't know about Randy Couture's chin these days. I think if James Toney, I mean, granted, Randy Couture has a longer reach, and obviously he's the MMA pro. As I've said many, many times before, all it takes is one punch. One good, solid punch to the temple from a professional puncher, and it doesn't matter how good of a wrestler you are. You get nailed with one of them cinder blocks, that may be the end of you when you've already gotten older and your chin has turned from marble to glass. So we'll see what happens. I don't necessarily count James Toney out just yet. But they marketed this fight, UFC versus boxing, you know. They created this whole story. They did the same thing with the Shane Carwin-Brock Lesnar fight. They did this with BJ Penn and Frankie Edgar. They tell you a story. The Anderson Silva-Chael Sonnen fight, there was a story here told by the guys in the fight. They've taken the best of professional wrestling and used it to sell real fighting. And it works. People buy into it. It creates emotion. Without emotion, there's no investment. With no investment, there's no viewers. Okay? There's going to be people who just love it for the pure sport of it and will watch MMA just to see the sport of it and don't want to get into any of the theatrics. But those people are not your bread and butter. The whole point of having a company is to make it expand and create wealth. And you have to make new fans out of people who've never seen an MMA fight before ever, not steal fans from the other company. So there was no story going into the Bobby Lashley fight. The story going into the middleweight title fight was bad. It was essentially the guy who was champion done up and left. You know, and then the one of the most notable guys, this guy King Mo, you heard it in the recap. He's got this ridiculous entrance that he does, and you know he's very into trying to market himself, his character, which was great. And yeah, okay, he was on the poster. King Mo should have been everywhere with the crown. King Mo should have been all over television promoting this thing. You know, and it's unfortunate that he lost ultimately, but you know what? Had this created more fans for Strikeforce, the loss would have been worth it. The problem here is that you had two guys, Bobby Lashley and King Mo, who both lost, and no new fans were created. You want to talk about a lose-lose situation for Strikeforce? Bush League. All right, and I really wanted to talk about this, so that brings us to the end of the show. We will see you next week here on the one and only Whiskey Rebellion.
We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.